Chapter 2. Marriage and Public Life. The successful military operations in behalf of the northern colonies of our country resulted, at the close of the Revolutionary War, in opening the whole territory along the northern frontier of the New England states and New York for the occupancy of the immigrant, and gave security in prosecuting the business of peaceful life. The desire of possessing a home in this new, healthy, and fertile region, which led so many families from western Massachusetts, the Miller family among them, induced other families from the Atlantic settlements, particularly in Rhode Island and Connecticut, to try their fortunes in the same region. Among the families which came from Connecticut about the time that the Miller family came from Pittsfield, there was one by the name of Smith. This family settled in Pulteney, Vermont, some half a dozen miles from the residence of Mr. Miller. The Smiths were related to families in the Miller neighborhood, and this brought the members of the two families into each other's society. It was in this way that the subject of this memoir first met with Miss Lucy Smith, a young woman of about his own age, who afterwards became his wife. There certainly is no relation which two human beings can sustain to each other on which their mutual welfare so much depends as that of husband and wife. To a great extent, their history and that of their children are determined by the fitness of the parties for each other and the manner in which the relation is sustained. If the wisdom and goodness of God are seen in the institution of marriage, these attributes are quite as manifest in the philosophical, inartificial, and religious manner in which he requires the institution to be honored. We shall see, by and by, that the importance of the duties growing out of this relation was a principal consideration in fixing Mr. Miller's purpose to become a Christian. As Mrs. Lucy Miller is now living, all that might be said to her praise may not be said here. It is sufficient to state that she was remarkably endowed by nature and by her industrial and economical habits to make domestic life highly agreeable and to favor Mr. Miller's promotion and success in the departments of public life in which he was called to move. And few men could be better adapted to enjoy or better qualified to honor the office of a husband than Mr. Miller. His warm-hearted and tireless sociability gave itself full play in the domestic circle, and his confidence was unbounded towards those whom he had decided to be worthy of it. The discernment which led Miss Smith to accept the offer of his hand was never called in question by a disappointment of her expectations. They were united in marriage June 29, 1803. By comparing dates, it will be seen that the subject of this memoir had passed his minority but a few months when this important change in his condition in life took place. Shortly afterwards, the new-made family settled in Pulteney, Vermont, where the young wife's parents resided. To the population generally, Mr. Miller was a stranger, and to those who knew him as the fortunate husband of one of the promising young ladies of the village, nothing very remarkable appeared in him to attract their attention. In fact, he does not appear to have been at that time, or during his subsequent life, either moved by external show in others, or led to make the least show to produce an effect on others. What was solid and unaffectedly natural and true was all he valued, or wished others to value as worthy of their attention. He had been distinguished by no other public honors, we believe, prior to his leaving Loehampton, but that of being promoted to the always dignified office of sergeant in the militia. However, he continued in Pulteney but a short time before it began to be perceived that his natural genius would make itself felt if it did not seek to make itself seen. One of the first objects of his interest, after he had become settled, was the village library. His constant use of its volumes brought him into the society of a superior class of men. His wife took a deep interest in his improvement and promotion, and made it her pleasure and business to relieve him as much as possible from all the family cares which might call him away from his books. She felt very sure that it would not be lost time on his part or lost labor on her own part. Still, the time he could devote to books on the best possible arrangement was not so much as he desired, for he had been trained to the farming business, and he made that his employment for some years in Pulteney. One effort of genius, though trifling in itself, which attracted towards him the public attention of the village and its vicinity, was a poetic effusion, the inspiration of his patriotic ardor. Preparations were going on at the time for the public celebration of the anniversary of our national independence, and the inspiration of that memorable day seized Mr. Miller while he was hoeing corn in the field. He had written poetry before, and so, after the labor of the field was done, he put his thoughts into a written form to be adapted to the familiar old tune called Delight. The appointed marshal or manager of the services of the day was Esquire Ashley, who was then a neighbor of Mr. Miller and afterwards became an intimate friend. But the poet of the day, as he became, was too reserved to offer his tribute, though there is reason to believe it would have been thankfully accepted, for the business of the manager hardly afforded him time to write poetry for the occasion, if he had the ability or even to select it. Mr. Miller was willing to have his piece seen and used if it was thought to be suitable, but he could not announce himself as its author. So he took the manuscript and walked, as usual, to Esquire Ashley's house. He seated himself leisurely below the chamber window, where that gentleman was making his preparations for the great celebration. Then, taking an opportunity to place it near where Mrs. Ashley was at work, he shortly afterward withdrew. As soon as Mrs. Ashley discovered the paper, she took it to her husband, supposing it was one of his papers which had fallen from the window. He took it and read the hymn. It struck him as being just what was wanted, but he knew nothing of its origin. It was carried to several others who were thought of as its author, but no author or owner of it could be found. Perhaps an angel from heaven had sent it. So they talked, at any rate. However, the hymn was copied with the pen, and the sheets multiplied to supply all who wished for one. The day came, and the hymn was sung with the greatest enthusiasm to the favorite old tune, Delight. But among those who distributed the copies, there was a worthy Baptist minister by the name of Kendrick, who had taken a warm interest in Mr. Miller. His suspicions had pointed him to the author of the piece, and when Mr. Miller came with others to get a copy, his appearance and manner confirmed Elder Kendrick's suspicions. Further inquiry brought forth a confession of authorship. To use the phrase of the old folks, it was a great feather in his cap. He had touched the right chord in the right way. The pious and patriotic emotions of the aged were revived. The ardent responses of the young to these parental emotions found expression in the new hymn, and nothing more was needed to make its author the popular favorite. It is not known that an entire copy of the hymn is now in existence. A sister of its author has repeated to us a few of the stanzas which we give, more for the purpose of exhibiting his religious and patriotic sentiments than from an expectation that our readers will be affected as were those who first heard it. Its style and meter were strictly in accordance with the standard contained in the hymn book used on Sundays, doubtless the only standard the writer of it was familiar with, and the effect arose from the natural force and simplicity of the versified thoughts and the perfect ease of the musical execution. But to the fragments of the hymn. Our independence dear, bought with the price of blood, let us receive with care and trust our Maker God. For He's the tower to which we fly, His grace is nigh in every hour. Nor shall Columbia's sons forget the price it cost, as long as water runs or leaves are nipped by frost. Freedom is thine, let millions rise, defend the prize through rolling time. There was a Washington, a man of noble fame, who led Columbia's sons to battle on the plain. With skill they fought. The British host, with all their boast, soon came to naught. Let traitors hide their heads, and party quarrels cease. Our foes are struck with dread when we declare for peace. Firm let us be, and rally round the glorious sound of liberty. The reader will see that the piece was designed for home consumption. It was exactly suited to the occasion and was marked throughout in spirit, style, and thought with the elements of his education. And this production, with others in prose and poetry, made him at once a notable in the community, secured to him a wide circle of friends, and opened the way for his promotion to office and honor. The old men were all ready to give him a lift, almost without distinction of party. The young folks made his house a place of common resort, to which they gathered to spend their leisure hours, while himself and wife became the central unit which drew them together and kept all in motion. It was here that Mr. Miller became a member of the Masonic fraternity, in which his perseverance, if nothing else, was manifested, for he advanced to the highest degree which the lodges then in the country or in that region could confer. In his political sentiments he was decidedly democratic, but he had intelligence enough to see that the practical patriotism of men did not depend so much on the party name they took as on their common sense and integrity. He knew that there were bad men enough in either party to ruin the country if they had the power to do it, and good men enough in the same parties to promote the public prosperity to the best of their ability. His position, therefore, was taken in view of the tendency of different political principles and public measures in their ultimate bearing on the established institutions of the country. He enjoyed, in a remarkable degree, the confidence of both the political parties of the day. The first public office of a civil character to which he was elected or appointed was that of constable. His appointment to the office of sheriff took place in 1809. The first entry of writs served and of executions levied as sheriff's deputy is dated December 6, 1809. A long list of writs and executions is still preserved in good condition in a book used for that purpose. The last writ in this list is dated 1811. The last execution is closed up in May 1813. The names of the attorneys which occur the most frequently in the issuing of these writs are R.C. Mallory, Esquire, and Chauncey Langdon, Esquire. One of these was the Republican and the other the Federal lawyer of the place. So much business from the lawyer of the party opposed to Mr. M. corroborates the statement we have heard as having been made by that official, that Mr. Miller was the only honest Democrat he knew. Indeed, in the various civil offices he was called to fill, constable, sheriff, and justice of the peace, he appears to have sustained an unimpeachable character and to have given the highest satisfaction. As an illustration of his standing in the confidence of the community, it may be stated that when he was called on to furnish bondsmen for his fidelity in the office of sheriff, responsible persons voluntarily offered their names so that several times the amount required was at his command. He had good reason to expect promotion to the office of high sheriff if he would restrain his military ardor and decline entering the army. In the case of most men of the world, with the avenues to honor, wealth, and domestic happiness wide open before them, it is not often that a public station so commanding would be voluntarily left for the hardships, privations, and dangers of the camp. What strong impulses could have turned him off in that direction? Already the business of his office had placed him in easy circumstances. Such was the amount of his business that he kept two horses, one of which he drove while the other was kept up to rest week by week alternately. He enjoyed the respect and unbounded confidence of the public, and he only needed to make himself still as worthy of public favor as he had been hitherto. And then, with life and health, all that this world could afford was within his reach. His preference for the army, so far as we know, sprang from these two motives. First, he desired to participate in the glory which rested on the memory of those he held the most dear in the history of his country and of his family. Second, he hoped to enjoy a more inviting exhibition of human nature in the scenes of military life than experience or books had afforded in civil life. His desire for something noble in character was greater than that for wealth or unsubstantial fame. He was satisfied with the trial of what was around him and wished to try a new field. This is stated by himself in his published memoir. In the meantime, I continued my studies, storing my mind with historical knowledge. The more I read, the more dreadfully corrupt did the character of man appear. I could discern no bright spot in the history of the past. Those conquerors of the world and heroes of history were apparently but demons in human form. All the sorrow, suffering, and misery in the world seemed to be increased in proportion to the power they obtained over their fellows. I began to feel very distrustful of all men. In this state of mind, I entered the service of my country. I fondly cherished the idea that I should find one bright spot at least in the human character as a star of hope, a love of country, patriotism. His military life must be given at length in another place. Happy indeed should we consider ourselves if there were no drawback to this apparent prosperity to be noted. Rarely is it the case that the honor of God and the honor of man are coincident. If Mr. Miller was not puffed up by the latter, he had lost much of his regard for the former. In his worldly advancement, there was a serious and dangerous departure from the Christian sentiments which were instilled into his mind during his early life. Still, there was no defect in his character which the most rigid worldly standard of external morality could detect. He was perfectly upright and honorable in all his dealings. He was generous, almost to a fault, with his friends, compassionate and liberal to the poor, and he held in the highest contempt every act that could tarnish a man's personal and private honor. He was not profane even to the extent that too many are who pass for gentlemen. He was not intemperate, although he was very much exposed to this ruinous habit, from the example of those into whose company his business called him, a habit which had broken down some of his predecessors in office by rendering them incapable of attending to their business. He escaped from it without the least stain. It could be shown from sentiments embodied in some of his essays, in addresses delivered before societies existing at the time, and in his poetic effusions, that his moral and religious views were of a type that would pass with the world as philosophical, pure, and sublime. But the men with whom he associated from the time of his removal to Pulteney, and to whom he was considerably indebted for his worldly favors, were deeply affected with skeptical principles and deistical theories. They were not immoral men, but as a class were good citizens and generally of serious deportment, humane and benevolent. However, they rejected the Bible as the standard of religious truth and endeavored to make its rejection plausible by such aid as could be obtained from the writings of Voltaire, Hume, Volney, Paine, Ethan Allen, and others. Mr. Miller studied these works closely and at length avowed himself a deist. As he has stated, the period of his deistical life to have been 12 years, that period must have begun in 1804, for he embraced or returned to the Christian faith in 1816. It may fairly be doubted, however, notwithstanding his known thoroughness and consistency, whether Mr. Miller ever was fully settled in that form of deism which reduces man to a level with the brutes as to the supposed duration of their existence. And the question is worthy of a little inquiry. To what extent was he a deist? Robert Hall, with his usual comprehensiveness and truth, has remarked that infidelity is the offspring of corrupt Christianity. It is much more successful in the discovery of supposed arguments against the existence of the deity of the Scriptures, in the perversion of that which is divine, than in its institution and appointed use. Voltaire chose the ruins of human nature in their most perverted and blighted condition, and Volney chose the ruins of human habitations for the theater on which to display their mighty but evil genius. And they conjured forth the same evil spirit which had instigated or caused the ruin, in each case, to utter a false testimony in reference both to ruined man and his ruined habitations. These men became the oracles of that falsehood to the world. But it was never the intention of God that man or the world fitted up for his habitation should be in this ruined condition. It is the work of rebellion and sin, of sin against the greatest displays of love and goodness that were possible, and against the purest and most reasonable law that could be given, of rebellion that was marked by contempt of the universal sovereign, and of authority enforced by the lightest test of submission. And God has spoken to us, to inform us that He has made provision for the restoration of all men, and that it is His purpose to restore all who become interested in that provision, with the world now in ruins, to a condition which no history but the Bible has made known. Paine could rail and belie the supernaturalism of the Bible like an incarnate demon, and then endorse all the supernaturalism of the most stupid pagan mythology in his patriotic and poetic productions which he published to the world. And that mind must be strangely out of balance naturally, or wretchedly perverted, which could bow to the authority of Volney's Spectre or Paine's paganism, the pure creations of fiction and superstition, and then reject the Bible because it demands faith in that which is not familiar to the senses. It is generally true that those who become decided skeptics take that most hopeless position because they have become so depraved or perverted that they feel the want of an infidel theory to afford them a license and quiet in their chosen course. It was not so with Mr. Miller. In the days of his greatest devotion to deistical sentiments, he desired something better. He had his difficulties with the Bible under its current interpretations, and he tells us what these difficulties were. But a man like him could never be made to believe it consistent or safe to abandon the Bible unless something more worthy of his trust were first put in its place. And such a condition must secure to that matchless book a certain and permanent supremacy. This was Mr. Miller's safety. But if the poison which had infused its taint into the system did not appear as a loathsome blotch upon the surface, its victim was not only kept away from the sole remedy, but that remedy was treated by him with an afflicting and dangerous levity. This was now the painful feature of his case. Once it was not so. When he was a mere boy between the years of 7 and 10, as he tells us, a sense of the plague of his heart and of his lost condition caused the deepest concern in reference to his future prospects. He spent much time in trying to invent some plan whereby he might find acceptance with God. He tried the common and most natural course in such a state of mind, that of being very good. "I will do nothing wrong, tell no lies, and obey my parents," he thought. But his mind was still unsettled and unhappy. Good works are very proper, but they can never be accepted as the price of pardon and redemption. He thought, too, as all do in the same state of feeling, that something might be effected by sacrifice. "I will give up the most cherished objects I possess." But this also failed. There is only one offering that can avail. In that, every sinner must rest his hope and plea, or remain without peace with God. The experience of Mr. Miller's childhood made him thoughtful and serious, if it did not result in the attainment of this inward sense of peace. Under his inward conflicts and apprehensions of worldly sorrow, when a young man, in 1803, he poured out his soul to religion in this touching strain: "Come, blessed religion, with thy angel's face, dispel this gloom and brighten all the place. Drive this destructive passion from my breast, compose my sorrows and restore my rest. Show me the path that Christian heroes trod, wean me from earth, and raise my soul to God." Two things, says D'Aubigny, are essential to sound Christian experience. The first is a knowledge of our condition as sinners. The second is a knowledge of the grace of God in its manifestations to the soul. Mr. Miller, like most, if not all, others, had learned the first in his early life. But he had evidently not then attained the second of these elements of a true religious life. And by not attaining that important position in the process of deliverance from our fallen condition, he became wearied of a sense of his need if he did not lose it entirely. In the chosen employment of his intellect, with a more ample supply of books at command, in the midst of an admiring and merry social circle, in receiving the honors of the world from the hand of his superiors, and in reaping an honorable portion of the treasures of the world, why should he desire any other source of enjoyment, and one altogether unknown, unappreciated, and unpopular, in the circle where he moved? What use had he for that religion he had seen verified and felt the need of, in the less cultivated family circle at Loughampton? If those who never become acquainted with the lessons of truth may be satisfied without the consolation of which its lessons speak, with those who are made familiar with these lessons, it is generally very different. They can seldom feel satisfied with themselves without making a hearty surrender of life and all God has given them to His service. As they know this is their reasonable service, anything short of this, they know, must be unreasonable. But how few take this narrow path? How many turn away to join the multitude? The talent, however, is in their hands. They must dispose of that if they will not submit themselves to the disposal of its giver. Some make it the reason for entertaining and venting a more malignant and blasphemous form of hatred against everything which bears the name of God. This quiets all fear of being reproached as religious, and it is the awful snare into which many are led by the fear of man. Another class of these unfaithful recipients of the talent of truth try to get along with a popular external expression of respect for its claims, and thus they escape the dreaded reproach. A third class, naturally too frank even to appear to venerate what they do not heartily respect, and too deeply impressed with the goodness of the deity to become blasphemers, but still too fearful of man to encounter his frown, seek to save themselves from it by making the defects of the humble but unpopular representatives of truth a subject of merriment. This course was taken by Mr. Miller. This is the class to which he then belonged. He banished from his memory the impressions of his early life and must silence all fear of reproach on account of them. So he gave to his skeptical associates an assurance that he had mastered his superstition, as they deemed it, by performing, for their sport, the devotions of the worship to which he had been accustomed, and especially by mimicking the devotional peculiarities of some of his own family relatives. Among these pious relatives there were two in particular, whose presence or name was calculated to remind him of his repudiated obligations, and whose influence over him he labored to repel by making them the theme of his mirth. One of these was his grandfather Phelps, pastor of the Baptist Church at Orwell. The other was his uncle, Elihu Miller, who was settled as pastor of the Baptist Church at Loehampton in 1812. These were men of unpolished exterior, but of decided character, strong voice, and ardent devotion. Men whose features were so strongly marked would make fine subjects for striking portraits. And if all their traits could be brought out, there would be found a large bestowment of the treasure of heavenly wisdom and virtue in the earthen vessel. It was the excellence of the heavenly traits and the roughness of the earthly which made them so desirable and so ready subjects of caricature. These humble ambassadors of Christ and other pious relatives often visited Mr. Miller's house at Pulteney, and although he received them with affection and respect, and entertained them in the most generous manner, he was in the habit of imitating with the most ludicrous gravity their words, tones of voice, gestures, fervency, and even the grief they might manifest for such as himself, to afford a kind of entertainment for his skeptical associates, which they seemed to enjoy with a particular relish. Little did he then think that he was measuring to these faithful men what was to be measured to him again, pressed down, shaken together, and running over. And probably it was not known to him that these praying men had already expressed the hope, almost a prophecy, that their prayers would be answered, and that he would some day be engaged in perpetuating the work they were endeavoring to advance. There was more than one heart that was almost inconsolably afflicted by this conduct of Mr. Miller. His mother knew of it, and it was as the bitterness of death to her. Some of his pious sisters witnessed with tears his improprieties. And when his mother spoke of the affliction to her father Phelps, he would console her by saying, "Don't afflict yourself too deeply about William. There is something for him to do yet in the cause of God." Although Mr. Miller avowed himself a deist and was recognized as such by deists, this offense against all propriety in trifling with what his dearest relatives regarded as most sacred, this thoughtless trifling with the humble messengers of the gospel, was the darkest feature in his character. To him, it was the most natural course which the circumstances of his position could suggest, and undoubtedly appeared to be the least violation of former convictions and educational proprieties which would allow him to stand as he did in the favor and confidence of his unbelieving associates. He had not then become acquainted with the source of strength by which he might have been sustained before the enemies of the Christian faith. He was unprepared to take the Christian position, and he became what the influences around him naturally determined. To give the true state of the case, the darker shades must appear with the lighter. He took the position of an unbeliever. But that he was not a deist of the rank type will appear more fully from his own statements, especially in his letters while in the army, which will be presented in the next chapter. We have thus stated Mr. Miller's social and public position, his worldly prospects, and his religious state. The long-suffering of God was still to be exercised towards him. He was to become satisfied with the insufficiency of the world. Then the light, which had become darkness, was to be revived within him. The breath of life from God would disclose the all-sufficient portion, and he would go forth to build again the faith he had destroyed. Many were the prayers that ascended in his behalf, and some of those who were the most deeply interested for him would pass away before their prayers would be answered. But the great lessons of long-suffering, of faithfulness, and of power to deliver out of the most artful snare of the adversary would be the more magnified on the part of God. The praying, who were yet alive, would hail the answer with greater joy, and the delivered one would be the better prepared to take others in the same fearful condition by the hand and lead them to him who came to seek and save the lost.